I'm Phil Pringle, and welcome to the C3 Church Global Podcast. Thanks for joining us today from wherever you are in the world. C3 Church Global is a family of almost 600 churches around the world, and this podcast is all about equipping pastors and leaders to lead healthy, growing, and multiplying churches. We are Christ-centered, Spirit-powered, and Connect-driven. Every week on this podcast, you will find new and uplifting content to strengthen you, equip you, and help you lead others into a relationship with Christ. You'll find a mix of devotionals that build your faith and your relationship with Christ, as well as rich and empowering conversations with leaders and friends in ministry from around the world. We also bring inspiring testimonies and updates from our pastors and churches throughout the C3 movement on the 64 nations that we're present in. Here's this week's podcast. Hey everybody, welcome to C3 Church Global Podcast. This is about all things local church and leadership, and it's a real pleasure to be here in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, with Mark Voragais and Kingdom City, and actually very generously, they've let us use their studio, but it is incredible to be here with Mark. God bless you, Mark.
Thank you, Phil. Privileged to be on your podcast.
Now you're in your 19th year. You're about to celebrate your 20th year as Kingdom City.
Yep.
And from my point of view, looking all around the globe, you'd be one of the movements that have got like a move of God happening. So what's the secret sauce behind you coming to last Easter? You baptized 550 people, largest in Perth, baptism in history in Australia.
Yeah, wow.
On one particular day. Yeah. What is the keys that have released this kind of move?
It's been an adventure for sure, because when I came to Malaysia 19 years ago, I did not think this would be the consequence. You know, I think you referenced it today. You sort of hit your goals, or you hit what you think you can build, and you just think, what do I do now? But honestly, I think there's a yes spirit that I obviously kickstarted, but now there's a whole bunch of people that have said yes. Yes to God, doesn't matter what he says, what he asks. So there's a yieldedness, there's a willingness, there's a hunger for adventure. I think hunger for God is probably a huge part of the atmosphere, because any environment where hunger is absent, at best it'll feel striving, at best it'll feel apathetic. And I think by God's grace, there's been a hunger. I wish it was a spiritual gift. I know it's not.
You wish spiritual hunger.
I wish I could lay hands on people and impart spiritual hunger. Right. I don't think it's not listed as a gift. It's not something you can impart, but if it was, it would be the most coveted gift, because I know if I laid hands on someone and they became spiritually hungry, I could leave them alone and their hunger would propel them in terms of their desires, That's in true. Terms of their disciplines. And I think all we're trying to do is create an atmosphere or a greenhouse or a space in which hunger could rise. And I think hunger for God becomes the, the fuel that has fueled it. I think spiritual hunger has been a huge part of that. And people have seasons with that.
Yeah.
No one's been perfectly spiritually hungry their whole life.
Right.
But I think if you can create an atmosphere where that's paramount. We've got 10 atmospheres, and I think that's certainly one of the most important ones. I think that we're the worship, the word, prayer, all the stuff that I think makes most movements tick, including C3.
Yeah, sure.
I think that's something we pursue. We've certainly got strategy and structure and systems, but they sit underneath the spiritual side. And I think that's been a huge part. The way I describe it, there's a revival atmosphere in a relational culture. So you've got to build on in the context of doing life. Mm-hmm. And I think if you have a revival atmosphere without a relational culture, you have great meetings, but that's it.
Yeah.
If you have a relational culture without a revival atmosphere, you've got a great social club.
Right.
But if you can have a revival atmosphere within the context of doing life and having fun together and keep enjoy the, I think that you're on
your
way.
Heaven.
Yeah.
It's not often, well, it's more rare that you'd find any leader of a church saying spiritual hunger is our top priority.
Right.
I think it's recognized as a necessity, but I think it'd be, for most, it'd be like a mystery as to how do I create spiritual hunger, a hunger for God in my people? How would you do that?
You know, that's a great question. I don't know that I have a really good answer apart from God fills the hungry. he doesn't feel the empty.
Right.
He feels the hungry.
Right.
A lot of empty people who are not hungry.
Uh-huh.
The hungry and the thirsty shall be filled.
Right.
He doesn't saturate the dry. He saturates the thirsty.
Right.
So I'm often talking to our people saying, turn. So you can be full and still hungry.
Yeah.
You can be saturated and still thirsty.
Uh-huh.
So the whole idea of hunger and thirst for me as a spiritual appetite is something that I maybe that's just who I am too. I like, honestly, there are moments where I'm like, God, I just want you. Like, I trade this whole thing in for you.
Are you talking about the Lord?
Talking to God.
Yeah.
And I think people, spiritual hunger, you can come either through life dealing you a whole bunch of blows and you have to turn to God.
Yeah.
But I'd rather fall on the rock and be broken than the rock fall on me and be crushed. Right. But either way, you're broken. And so I feel there is something about hunger. And I do feel like when you get a few hungry people together, it becomes contagious. It's right. Like if you ever gone to a restaurant and you don't know what to order and you see someone devouring their food and you're like, that looks good. Because hunger begets hunger, I think, yes. To some degree.
Yeah.
You know, just when you have a fanatical worshiper, and I'm not talking style, I'm talking a genuine thirst and desire. Yeah. So look, people express it differently. People have different language for it, maybe. But to me, once an atmosphere is void of appetite, void of hunger, it's a leader driving it or a worship leader driving it or a preacher driving
right.
it. Yeah, you know, whereas a hungry person will cross over barriers to pick up a crumb. And I think when people are hungry, God's word is he fills that.
Yeah.
He'll bypass 1,000 full people to find one hungry one.
Exactly.
And so I think whether you're a small church, large church, or anything in between, if there's hunger present,
mm-hmm.
God promises to fill it.
Yeah, the weird thing about God stuff is that when you eat it, it makes you hungrier.
That's right.
So just to get people actually studying scripture,
yes,
to do a Bible study,
yes,
if we could stop looking at our devices and movies and books and just study, do a Bible study for half an hour,
yeah,
it whets your appetite.
Absolutely.
It doesn't satisfy you. It's like, I want to do this again. And I think prayer,
yes,
could be similar.
Yes.
That if people stop praying, they lose the appetite for prayer. But if you actually start praying and you feel the presence of God, you actually think, man, I want this. I want more of this.
Well, this is where the kingdom is an upside down kingdom. In the natural, to get hungry, you don't eat.
Right.
But in the spiritual, you don't eat, you lose your appetite.
Yes.
And I think that's basically what you enunciated then. And I think that is where, if you can, the psalmist said, taste and see.
Right.
And it was to fuel an appetite, not to fill one.
Right.
And I think it fuels something in the average believer. And that's where answered prayer is so powerful. Encounters are so powerful. Testimonies are so powerful because it sort of goes, if God can do it there, he can do it here. If he did it for him, he can do it for me. And there's there's an awakening of thirst that itself is a self-fulfilling magnet.
Right.
And I think all the stuff that flows out of it, of course, we need our systems and our structures. I'm massive on culture. I'm big on creating unity in the team, and I'm all of that stuff, leadership, I'm down with it, and I'm hungry for that too.
Yeah.
But I think you can have all of that and miss the appetite for God in itself.
Right.
Intimacy with God begets influence with man.
Say that again.
Intimacy with God is the trigger for the influence with man. It's a lot of churches and leaders want influence with people.
Yeah.
But to me, you pursue intimacy with God, and you will have influence with man, because there is something about someone that know their God. Intimate knowing will be strong and do great exploits. So I just feel like it's been a personal pursuit of mine.
Right.
I would be lying to you if I told you that right throughout my entire life I was equally hungry and I've only ever got hungry. So I've had my seasons like everyone else.
Yes.
But I think I return to that point where I'm like, God, if I don't have you,
yeah.
What am I doing? Like, this is great, but
yeah. So here's kind of a Calvinist question. Do you think that is a sovereignly planted desire by God, that hunger for him? Because it would seem like some people are just completely uninterested and disinterested. Or else do you think it is something that every person can cultivate?
Well, that's a great question. I think I don't want to cop out, but I think it's both. I think obviously it is the Lord who draws.
Right.
Right. He first loved us. Mm-hmm. He's the one that draws us.
Right.
But I do think that he puts options in our heart and in our hand.
Right.
And the more you pursue him, as we talked earlier, the more your appetite grows. What you feed grows, what you starve dies.
Right.
And so I do think there's an appetite. And so part of it is, and I think life has a way of giving you those moments. Like sometimes some people return to God in tragedy. Some people turn to God when they go through trial. Others get harder when they go through tragedy or trial. So there's clearly a sovereignty in there somewhere that I don't want to try and make it sound like we've done all the work and we're great because we're hungry. But I absolutely think that we're responsible for our own hunger to some degree.
Yeah.
You can fill yourself with stuff and then have no appetite.
Right.
And then you can call it the sovereignty of God that hasn't drawn you far enough. But I do think, and I've had seasons where I'm like, oh man, oh, whatever, I can't, you know, okay, look, just do my thing and whatever. Right. And the other scene's like, God, I just, and you feel a drawing. So I do think there's a divine edge to that.
Yeah.
But creating a culture around that, it's like saying, is an encounter sovereign or a byproduct of your own pursuit?
Right.
Well, it's probably both. It's probably sovereign. But then the question is, what do you do to steward that encounter?
Yeah.
You know, Moses kept his face shielded.
Yes.
Because I think he wanted the glory as long as he could off the mountain.
Yes.
And I think there's something about when you taste of the presence of God, when you taste of his reality, of his goodness, that it's then incumbent upon me and you. So there is a part we play.
Yeah.
To go, God, I want to feel this. I want to steward this. Yeah. I want to throw myself into that space. I want to seek and find. I want to ask and receive. I want to knock and let the door be opened.
I think maybe... you get motivated by, like you say, tragedy, trial, or sometimes, you know, mostly it would be a positive encounter with the presence of God. And you say,
absolutely.
I want more of this.
Absolutely.
And then in that time of being motivated is the best time, I would think, to set up disciplines.
Absolutely.
In your life.
Absolutely.
That will keep you going when the motivation runs dry and you just keep doing it. And even though you're not that excited about the whole thing, just doing it can re-engage your heart and get you going again through the dry times.
There'll be seasons where the wind blows, and when the wind blows, you put your sail up and it'll take you further than all your rowing in your own strength.
Yeah.
But then there's also times to just row the boat.
Right.
And it's like, okay, nothing seems to be happening, but you know what? I'm going to stay consistent.
Right.
But when the wind blows, put your sail up.
Yeah.
Because there's going to be seasons of refreshing, seasons of visitation, seasons of encounter, seasons of just feeling there's an open heaven, you know, things are working. And there are other seasons you're going to have to row.
Well, it seems to me, looking on at Kingdom City as a move, and I haven't been in amongst all of your conferences, but just looking on, it would seem that you are one of the courageous leaders, pastors in today's church world who's quite free and open about the moving of the Holy Spirit, about supernatural encounters happening in your services and from what I've seen. And like in the last 20 years, that area has been quietened down a bit.
Mm.
You know, like people feeling a little embarrassed about it, a little bit too weird or something. Mm-hmm. But recently, definitely, there's an awakening, a fresh awakening and desire.
Mm.
And where I travel, because I've been involved in that arena quite a bit.
Mm.
People are saying, yeah, we want that. And I think coming out of COVID, when you couldn't have altar calls, I think the altar needs rebuilding.
Absolutely.
And that doesn't mean just altar calls out the front, but the whole sense of fire falling from heaven, the power of God moving. Do you think that's playing a part in what's happening at Kingdom City?
I think so. I think what you said about COVID was true, but I think we had always tried to value that even beforehand. I mean, even the early years of starting a church. By the way, you have to create culture. It doesn't just automatically happen.
Right.
So I remember the first time I held a prayer meeting in KL. We're just starting. It's a small church. There's no movement, no thousands, whatever.
Right.
And no one's praying. So I'm like, before you got to create a culture through example, not through instruction.
Right.
You know, if you lead by instruction, you can create an outcome. But if you lead by example, you create a culture. And I think once you model it, once you are it. So I remember praying in the prayer meeting. I was the only guy praying. And I'm leading the prayer meeting. And then I'm like, there's no one else to hand the mic to. It's only me. So I'm there. And you can tell these are staff. I don't mean like the backslidden lukewarm. They're looking at me like, this guy's a bit out of control. I just think the average spiritual temperature is so low that when someone normal comes along, they all think he has a fever.
Okay.
And they'll call them fanatical. But you know what a fanatic I found is? A fanatic is just simply someone with stronger convictions than me.
Right.
Like, we all go support the same football team.
Yeah.
I go normally. Someone else takes their shirt off, paints the colors on their face. And I'm like, fanatic. We're both on the same side, cheering the same team, worshiping the same God, wanting the same outcome. Someone just has a little bit more passion and conviction around it. And so the stories in the scripture, like the king who struck the arrow ground three times. And the prophet said, if you'd done five or six, you would have got a greater victory. Because I would have found it much easier if the prophet said, strike the ground six times.
Yes.
Then that's obedience.
Yes.
But it wasn't an obedience test. It was a passion test.
That's right.
Strike the ground. Well, let's see. Well, how many times? Well, I just strike it.
Yeah.
And you, if you struck it, it was a test of your hunger, not a test of your obedience.
Yeah.
So I feel like that. I love the story of David. You referenced it, which I found it was, again, I look for fresh material to challenge my hunger. And you said something that did it for me. I've always loved David in the Bible because even as a king, he was undignified and he worshipped.
Right.
But then you made a reference into his sheer wealth and what he put into the treasury and all of that. I thought, my gosh, I'm never giving a rich person an excuse anymore.
Right.
Like, that guy was the richest man in his world.
Yes.
And he, as a king of wealth, he was, I knew he was wealthy, obviously, David. But the way you framed it made me think, so what on earth is stopping me from, I want to get hungrier for God as I grow.
Right.
Regardless of my title, position, space, when 60s, 70s, 80s, whatever.
Yeah.
That to me is it. If one day I'm going to see him and be with him, why wouldn't I have a thirst for him here?
Right. Well, David seemed to jump right out of the Old Testament into the New in terms of he had a personal relationship with God.
Yeah.
I don't think it's hard to find anybody else in the Old Testament who had such intimacy with God. I think most of them were at the bottom of the mountain, and we'll leave it to Moses just to do all the close-up stuff, we'll stay away. We're too nervous about this God.
Yeah.
But here's David saying, my heart pants for you.
Yeah.
Like the deer after the water.
Yeah, I love it.
And so he's going, somewhere he's thinking, I just want to get with you. I just want to be with you, Lord. And obviously that's why God chose him, because he was after God.
Absolutely.
Had that hunger for God.
Yeah.
And wealth, it seemed, did not dilute it.
No.
Power or fame did not tear it down. We know he made some, pretty unfortunate mistakes, terrible mistakes, but at the same time, even in the mistake, he's still repenting ferociously in Psalm 51 and 32. And he is like so sorry.
Yeah.
It isn't like he doesn't care.
No.
Oh, well, I just blow it off. But he's still passionate for God, even in his worst moments. And, take not your Holy Spirit from me.
I love it. Absolutely.
Yeah, and so that's been fascinating. Now, you're obviously putting a lot of structure into the vision.
Yeah.
And it was a brilliant presentation. You put the visual up on the screens and everybody could see where you're going. And then you announced the pathway to the fulfillment of that, which is a leadership pipeline.
Right.
Can you talk a bit about, like, first of all, let's understand that in the last 20 years, you went from one small group right here in KL in a cafe to how many now?
There's 38 churches now, 38 locations.
Yeah.
About 60,000 people, roughly.
Right.
Between those 38 locations. And I think that represents 18 different countries.
Yeah. That's amazing. And what's that average per congregation?
So there would be probably about 1,500 to 1,600. That's an average size if you just divide the numbers.
Yeah, yeah.
But we've got churches that have just started that are 120 people, right through to the larger ones in the thousands, 4,000, 5,000, 6,000, 7,000.
Amazing.
So I think there is a spectrum because, it's like the oldest two churches are Cale and Perth.
Right.
And then we did that for 7 years of the 19. And then it's only in the last 7 years we've started all these other new ones.
Okay.
So they're still quite young. So I think they'll all grow in time and space.
They will.
But that's roughly where it's at. And I think my reference was, it's a miracle we've got here. Now, it's always a miracle because it's God.
Yeah.
However, I said the intentionality around the next 20 years, and I've been inspired by yourself. I've been inspired by movements like C3 Global around the world, where I think, wow, God, but you did that in the 80s and 90s and 2000s. Right. We should be learning off the back. We should be standing on the shoulders of giants and just believing you for more. I mean, it's been done.
Well, you are believing for more. And it's heartening to see You know, it reminded me listening to you of about 30 years ago.
Right.
You know, us setting the vision and dots all over the maps and, you know, this is where we're going and what we're doing.
Wow, that's so cool.
And it was fascinating. And the videos we produced to convey the vision. And it's awesome to see others picking up a whole idea of church planting and becoming church planting movements, which in my view is the baseline for what being a disciple maker is.
Absolutely.
So disciple making in the context of the local church is the hope of the world. And to see you now strategizing for what, 1,000 churches, was it?
Yeah, I think that's the minimum. I mean, that's what we're believing for. I think we're cut from the same cloth in this regard. I think church planting is the key to making disciples of all nations.
Yes.
You can run events, you can run conferences, you can run crusades, but if underneath all of that isn't the relational app culture of doing life and supporting one another and loving one another, it's in the context of one another that real discipleship happens. I mean, Jesus picked two brothers. Like, I mean, if me and my brother are fighting, pick me or pick him. Don't pick both of us. Like, we want to follow you and not deal with each other. And then they pick the tax collector.
Tax collector probably, and the Zionist.
Yeah, I'm like, you know, so God's like, part of following me is you're going to have to get along in the context of relationship. Church is where it happens.
Yeah.
And I feel like church planting, church leadership, all of that, for all its imperfections, I know it's not as romantic as some of the other things, which is why I talked about, if your mission is to make disciples, giving into a local church is giving to mission.
Yes.
If your mission is to make disciples.
Yes.
Because it's not as rosy and as glamorous as some other.
Yeah.
And I'm not knocking any other cause.
No.
I just think this is the bread and butter. Jesus said, I'll build my church. He didn't say he'll build many of the other things. He said he'll build his church. And to partner with that, to me, sounds like a good idea.
It is. That was a great point that you made. And I'm taking that away with me, that oftentimes people who are giving, especially quite wealthy people, will feel that giving outside the church to more exotic, kind of further away situations is somehow within their preference. They can do that if they're locally tithing. And I agree.
Sure.
It's within their preference.
Yeah.
But I think that to support a local church that's reproducing local churches, reproducing local churches, and planting those altars for God, those gates of heaven around the earth, in my mind, I'm not sure you can do anything greater than that.
No. And then people come to those local churches and say, well, what's your church doing to help people? I'm like, this church is helping people.
Yes.
Like, you know, there's this idea of kingdom and church, which is a weird distinction, because to me it's like, oh, we do courses for the community, not for the church. And then they come in from the community, get saved, join the church, and oh, we don't worry about you. I understand the evangelism heart behind reaching people. That's what church should be.
Yeah.
However, I just think there's a lot of false lines around that. I don't know for what reason, but I'm just passionate about making sure people see the local church as the absolute heartbeat of transformation and the essence of mission.
Yeah.
That is mission.
Yeah.
Like, unless you live in an Amish community, everyone in our church goes to schools, shops at public shopping centers, drives on roads. We're all part of the community. So there's no church in community. Church is community.
Yeah. I remember one year our church combined with Woolworths and a couple other firms, and we ended up delivering $3 million worth of food and supplies to people who were suffering in the drought in the outback of New South Wales.
Right.
And if we had never had the building and had the facilities in which to package all the food and to do all the, we would never have been able to do that. So actually, through building the building, having a local church, we are able to exercise a lot more in social justice than we would if we made social justice as our top priority.
Right.
I think it is a priority, but
absolutely,
I don't think it's the top. If building the local church, then you got the people with justice and mercy as their heart, they can find an expression through that.
Absolutely.
But then the worship people can, and the women's ministries can, and the youth ministries, everybody finds that working together in a local church, you actually fulfill heaven on earth.
And you know, if someone said to me, or someone said to you, what's C3 Global doing for the poor? What they mean is, show us your brochures, show us your mission board, show us some of your projects. But the real answer is, if you want to see what C3 Global is doing for the poor, you're going to give me 5 years. I need to go and interview hundreds of thousands of people in all over the world and go, oh, that one sponsors a World Vision Church. That one does compassion. That one volunteers as an orphan. That one does this. They support. Because what they're looking for, what do they mean is what are the group projects? But yes. Really, you're building a community
yes.
of transformed people
yeah.
who are then reaching out in their own expression.
Yeah.
So then in 5 years, I'll come back with a list. This is what C3 Global is doing for the poor. Because we only eternity will ever tell the impact of transformed people.
Totally. Yes.
So yes. I don't like feeding the sharks who have their demand around we need this and we need that. I just think, and I'm not negative. This is not my soapbox, but I do feel that if we can build disciples and help people transform people.
It's amazing. Well, congratulations, Mark and Jemima, on doing such an amazing job with Kingdom City. And we look forward to talking with you again next week. See you soon. Hey, thanks so much for joining us today. Check out more content on the C3 Church Global Instagram and YouTube page. C3 is a movement of many hundreds of churches around the world, Christ-centered, Spirit-powered, and connect-driven. So wherever you are around the world, I encourage you to find a C3 church near you. See you again soon.